Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to Racing Lives. My name's Aurélie Donzelot, and in this podcast, I use motorsport as an excuse to chat to some of the most inspiring women I know. Each week brings a different guest, and we discuss everything from career beginnings to what it's truly like to be involved in one of the fastest sports in the world. My guest today is known in every motorsport paddock there is, having worked in Formula One, touring cars, endurance racing and rallying, and many more, I'm sure, throughout her incredible career. She counts roles such as TV presenter, pit lane reporter, media trainer, event host, racing driver, and team PR as part of her extensive experience. She's as approachable and funny as she is professional and efficient, with a reputation for a calm and capable approach, which always guarantees a good work day when collaborating with her. My guest today is the utterly brilliant Louise Goodman.
Thank you very much. What a lovely introduction.
Thank you. I wrote it myself, but you did all the work.
That's very kind of you.
Oh, thank you. Well, listen, Louise, the more I do these, the more I realise it's a lot easier if we just start at the beginning. So if you don't mind, could you tell me where and when your racing life actually began?
As a kid, I loved things with wheels and an engine. I just, you know, one of my greatest joys as a child and a relatively small child was being allowed to park the car in the garage when my dad got home. And I have great memories of, you know, going around picnic areas in the New Forest, sitting on my dad's knee, you know, with me doing the steering wheel and him doing the pedals. So don't ask me where that came from. And there was no sort of history of motor racing or anything like that in my family. But I just love that. You know, a lot of my misspent youth was misspent on the back of motorbikes. But I never set out to work in racing. I didn't really have any idea what I wanted to do career-wise. I sort of fell into journalism, which in hindsight was a good thing for me because I'd always loved English was one of my best subjects at school. History was one of my favourite subjects at school. So I kind of fell into journalism through family or friends of mine who's they had a business building offshore powerboats. And I started working for a small publishing company on a magazine called Powerboat Water Skiing Magazine. So and through that, I met connections in the motor racing world. I met up with a guy called Tony Jardine, who was just setting up his own PR company. He'd been working in motorsport for quite a while, setting up his own company and was looking for somebody to go and work with him. I was looking for another job because I was planning to go away traveling. So I was working evenings in a restaurant. So I wanted a sort of easier job than editing the magazine. And Tony offered me a job, so I went to work for him. And that really was my entree into the world of motorsport. And it kind of went on from there. You know, Tony and I together, we sort of launched Camel as a sponsor into Formula One when they sponsored the Lotus team. I was assigned as the press officer when we got the BP contract. I was assigned as the press officer for the Leighton House team, who BP was sponsoring. And then I was approached by Eddie Jordan to go and be his press officer at Jordan. And from there, the opportunity came from ITV. So I always sort of say that my career has been a set of happy circumstance, really. You know, as I said, I never set out to work in this world, but it's a world that suits me wholly and has given me a very enjoyable career and life as well.
What about motorsport itself? Were you always a fan, or did that happen when it came to find you effectively?
It sort of happened when it came to find me. I mean, I was aware of motorsport. I grew up in a town in Hampshire called Alsford, which is where Derek Warwick comes from. And I, as a child walking to school, I would walk past Warwick Trailers, the family business, where there was a really sexy Mark II Ford Capri that was always parked outside that I lusted after. And I was aware of Derek. You know, he was always in the local paper. He was stock car racing at the time. It was before he got into Formula One. So I was aware of motorsport. Some of my friends, you know, my mates all liked motorbikes and cars. A couple of them did some sort of amateur racing. You know, I can remember going to the British Grand Prix. Don't ask me what year. It was at Brands Hatch. It would have been in the early mid 80s. You know, my first experience of going to a Grand Prix. So I liked it. It was that whole wheels and engine thing. It stirred something in me. But, you know, That was it. I had no particular knowledge of it, no family history of it, which I think is very often the way that people get into it. I suppose also the other influence was James Hunt, who was when I was a small kid, he was this kind of sexy dude who was all over the television. Him and Barry Sheen were big stars at the time, and they would appear on light entertainment shows. And, you know, so I'd sit down and watch James Hunt racing at the Monaco Grand Prix and that kind of thing. So that was there in the background as well. But no, it's not as if, you know, I come across so many people now who from year dot, their burning ambition has been to work in motorsport, to work in Formula One. And I feel a bit guilty because, I have had what to me seemed like a very easy entree and a lucky entree into a sport and into a working life that so many people yearn for and strive so hard to get into. And I feel to a certain extent like it fell into my lap. I know you have to be able to deliver the goods to progress in any line of business, but I guess particularly in a competitive area like motorsport. But I've been presented with opportunities, which I'm very grateful for.
And looking from the outside, I think I can safely say you've not wasted any of them. So I don't think you should feel too guilty.
Well, I hope not. I know my former partner, John Boy, used to sort of, when I said I've been very lucky, he'd rail against me and say, it's not down to luck. You know, you've got to be able to do the job. You do a good job. You've always done it well. That's why people want you to do it. So, but it sounds a little bit conceited to say that yourself, doesn't it?
Yeah, let everyone else say it. We're all here waiting to say it. It's completely fine. Actually, talking about looking on the outside, what would you say the biggest misconception about your job has been?
I think, you know, people have a perception, and rightly so, because that's how the sport portrays itself, that Formula One is very glamorous. It's a very, glamorous arena to work in. And it is a very glamorous sport, but when you're working in it, it's far more glamorous if you're sitting upstairs in the paddock club with a glass of champagne watching the race. You know, when you're actually working in the sport, it's long hours. It takes dedication. It's I've always described it as a way of life rather than a job, because it takes up a lot of your time. And you've got to, I think, love motorsport to be prepared to give up the time and put in the effort in order to do the job properly. But you can't be a fan. You're not there to fanboy or fangirl the drivers. You know, you've got to earn people's respect for whatever job it is that you're doing, and you've got to be very professional. So I think that is probably the biggest misconception, is that, you know, it's very, very glamorous. I mean, there are, you know, times it's not. I can remember many years ago at the Canadian Grand Prix, it was absolutely lobbing it down with rain. I was, you know, smothered in a and boys, because when I first started working in Formula One, there are so few girls on the teams that we never got female clothing. We always had to adapt the boys team gear. So I was smothered in this great big boys rather ugly anorak with a bundle of paper press releases. This is sort of pre the electronic age, walking up through the paddock to the media center to hand those out to the journalists, alongside a lady called Annie Bradshaw, who everybody in the paddock will know was the sort of the doyen, one of the first sort of female press officers, and a great positive influence for me when I was first working in Formula One. And we, you know, sheltering ourselves and our press releases from the rain, and we looked across, and there were a bunch of the Italian drivers' wives and girlfriends all looking frightfully glamorous. They were affectionately known. I say stress affectionately known as the Stitch and Bitch Club, because they'd all gather together and gossip and have a chat. And that the stitch came because back in those days, very often it was the driver's wives or press officers like Muggins here who ended up sewing patches onto their ovals when you got new sponsors and that kind of thing. And we looked across at these glamorous women, and there's Annie and I just, you know, and kind of looked at each other and said, we're in the wrong part of this, aren't we? This is not glamorous at all. Not at all.
Actually, one of the questions that I like to ask is, at what point did you realise your job wasn't glamorous at all? I think
They won when they presented me with a pair of boys' shorts that were far too big and a shirt that came down to my knees and said, there you go, there's your team gear, get on with it. It's like, oh, great. Right, I'm not here to be glamorous, am I, obviously.
Oh, we know it's not. It's fine. And the shirt down to your knee thing still happens. I can tell you that. That's for sure.
That's when the needlework skills came. Actually, I never bothered with the needlework. I just cut the bottom off with a pair of scissors and tuck it in. Thankfully, that was the days of you know, big belted cinched in trousers and stuff. So that was my excuse for it looking vaguely fashionable. That was the best I could do.
You made it work. Brilliant. Yeah, I don't know what my excuse now is. I think I can just try and wear really high trousers. I'm not even going to try. Yeah, it's a great colour. That's what I'm saying. What about, I always think motorsport's very competitive, and I'm not necessarily a competitive person when it comes to external factors. I'm very competitive for myself. I'm very driven. But I find that I absorb the spirit of competition that surrounds me, and I end up applying it to my job, which doesn't necessarily have a competition with the other teams, but I very much find myself doing that. Have you felt that spirit of competition throughout your career, and how have you dealt with it?
Oh, I felt that way before my career ever came about. I came out of the womb competitive, I think. You know, I wanted to win every game at parties. I wanted to be fastest in the, you know, egg and spoon race. I'm just a competitive beast. So yeah, I mean, you know, back in those early days of physically taking your press release to the media centre, I prided myself on being first person there. Yes, done it again. I'm the first person in the media centre with their press releases. And so, I mean, to me, I love competition. I am a very competitive person. I love that competitive aspect of it. I love the part of being a team, whether that was actually working within a racing team or now working, you know, in a media team. And I think, you know, obviously when you're working for a racing team, you want your cars, your drivers to do the best. As I said, there is that bottom level competition between, you know, getting to the media center, first of all. And I think even now as a journalist and as a reporter, I was so determined when I started doing television. I wanted to get the first interview with Eddie Jordan when Jordan, my former team, won a Grand Prix, which I did. And I told Eddie beforehand he was dead if he gave that interview to anybody else. And I remember ITV's final race in 2009 when 2008, 2009, when Lewis won his first championship, 2008. Again, I was absolutely determined to get the first interview with him. And that was a proper, I mean, if you look at the shots now, it was lobbing it down with rain. It was before the days when all of the drivers were brought to a media pen and it all happened in a, you know, a far more organised manner. Back then, the top three drivers would be brought to the pen and it was elbows out for the rest of them. And obviously, Lewis hadn't finished on the podium. So I was skulking around after him, following him around, making sure that, you know, I could get that first interview. So, and that was something I'd always done as an ITV reporter. One of the guys I worked with, my producer, Steve Alders, would be my spotter. So I would get word from Steve as to which entrance the driver was coming through the paddock. And you'd have to casually just stroll off looking like you weren't going anywhere. And again, this is before the drivers were brought to the reporters. At this point, we went to find the drivers. And it was important to get to them first or early because, you know, what racing drivers are like. Once they've told the story four times, they're getting bored of talking about it and you don't get such a good interview. So I'd get word from my Steve would say, okay, I think I can see a bike approaching from such and such. He'd say that to the guys in the truck, the producers in the truck. They'd send through to me the word, and I'd have to subtly sort of slope off as if I was just going for a casual stroll, hoping, because a lot of the other reporters would follow me around because they knew that I had this system of finding out where the drivers were. So I'd have to subtly sort of stroll off and hope that they didn't all follow me. And I always had big battles with Kai Abel, who was did the same job as me for RTL, who, always thought that he should definitely have first dibs at any of the German or any of the German speaking drivers, and was really pissed off with me if I got to Michael Schumacher before he did. Oh, I had to suffer the wrath of Kai on several occasions. But so, that I don't have that anymore in touring cars, because obviously, we are the prime TV station. The drivers always come to me first. So I think I've earned that right now, though, after all these years of chasing after them. It's about time the buggers came to me.
Too freaking right. They should know what's good for them. Actually, that leaks beautifully to what I'd also like to ask you, which is success. And how do you define success for yourself? Is it getting that interview each time and keep getting it?
I think it probably is. I think I was thinking about this before we started chatting, and it's not something I've actually spent a lot of time consciously thinking about. What is my own success? How do I define my own success? I guess on a broad level, the fact that I'm still here several decades, I won't give the number, but after I first walked into the Formula One paddock as a very naive, slightly scared young girl or young woman, the fact that I'm still here, I'm still being employed, I'm still earning a living, I guess that in itself is probably my biggest feeling of success. Because as you know, it's a very competitive industry throughout. It's an industry a lot of people want to work in. So I guess I must be doing something right in the fact that I'm still gainfully employed and, paying my mortgage and feeding my dog through it. So that really is the ultimate success, I think, is the longevity of my career, I think. And I guess there'd be all those little milestones along the way. But as I said at the beginning, it's not something I've really spent much time reflecting on. I think, I don't know whether other people do. It's just kind of not really my way, I don't think.
I think a lot of the reasons why people think about success at the moment, I think there's a tendency to try and define your goals and try and define, what dream are you going to chase next, which is, I think, is probably quite recent, actually. As far as motorsport is concerned, I think it's because we see success so well defined. You get to climb on a podium and you get to pick up a trophy. So you see success right in front of you. And then you have to decide, well, if I'm not part of that podium, what is my success?
Despite being a competitive person, that's never been part of my nature, possibly to my detriment in some ways. I see people who they've got a clearly defined path of what they're going to do and how they're going to get there. It's just never been my way. I think I just instinctively move along from one thing to another. And that process has served me very well. I mean, I think the only real hiccup was when ITV announced that they were pulling out of Formula One and suddenly I had no job. And that was the first time I'd really had to sit down and think, what are you going to do? How are you going to earn a living? What do you want to do with the rest of your working life? The first time I'd ever made that conscious decision, that was when I set up my media training company, because I became aware of the fact that working in TV broadcasting is slightly precarious. You're at the whim of other people. It's out of your control. And I felt it was important to have something that was within my control. But even with my own company, I business plan, never done one of those. I just kind of blob along. It's wrong. I know it's wrong. I know the theory of it. You're supposed to set yourself targets. But I'm just kind of, I just blob along. And to be honest, I'm generally running to keep up with myself from a work perspective. It's only when it gets to the winter that things quieten down a bit, and all those jobs that you're supposed to do and were supposed to do 5 years ago, like update your website and do your marketing material. And, I think, I really should get on with those. But then more media training work comes in and it's like, great. Yes, I can focus on that instead. So, that's just the way I've always operated. And it's not really, it's not really done me any harm. It's served me pretty well, I think. Not to be advised, some mentor would say. Set yourself goals. Set yourself targets.
Oh, I think do you and see where it goes, definitely.
I just think if you go through my theory has always been, if you go through life with blinkers on, with a real target for what you want to do, you miss opportunities that come in. And that's how my career has evolved, is opportunities. You know, I got involved in the magazine because through some friends, I met a lady who was editing the magazine at the time. You know, through working there, I met Tony Jardine, who said, "Do you want to do this?" It's always been opportunities that have come my way. And I think if I'd had blinkers on, thinking, right, I'm doing this for a year and a half and then I'm going to do that, maybe I wouldn't have had my eyes open to those opportunities. Or is that just my way of excusing my lack of planning?
No, well, it sounds very convincing. You sold it to me. I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I hope I haven't had blinkers on. No, that's a good point, actually. I'm fairly certain I'm very good at looking out for opportunities. It's those signs, isn't it? I hate it when you get a sniff of something and you ignore it. That's just a waste.
So there have been times in my career when I've been kind of thinking, feel like doing something, what I'm going to do, but you know, I'll stick my head back in the sand. I'm very good for sticking my head in the sand and procrastinating, and then ultimately something's come along. It's like, that's why I didn't make a decision, because it's been made for me now, because this opportunity has come my way. So it's worked.
So you could flip that as well and just said, you know, you didn't have the gut feeling, it didn't feel quite right, so you knew something else was coming. Talking about work so much, how do you actually balance it with the rest of your life? Do you have a work-life balance? And how would your friends say the same thing?
I think my friends have all got used to the fact that I'm going to miss a lot of things from, you know, March to November. My family have got used to family weekend, right, let's go through the racing calendar, and that's got more complicated now. I've got nieces and nephews who are working age and have their own lives and jobs that involve weekend work as well, and with friends, you know, it's all that most of them have ever known me doing, so it is what it is. I mean, I don't feel like I'm missing out. No, that's not true. I do miss out on things. I'm aware of the fact I miss out on things. But, you know, life's all about compromises, isn't it? If you want to have every weekend off and go to festivals and go to parties and, you know, go over the road. I'm lucky to have a little polo club in my village. You know, every weekend my dog spends more time at the polo than I do, because she'll, you know, a girlfriend who she'll go and stay with on race weekends will take her there, so she has a better social life in the village than I do. But yeah, you know, it is what it is.
Fair enough. What about stress, which I suspect might come from when you're overloading yourself, but do you actually experience stress? And how do you deal with it?
I quite like stress, actually. I think I perform at my best when I've got that edge. You know, I can remember back in my Jordan days, and I was the media department back then. I mean, okay, teams were a lot smaller. When I joined Jordan, I think I was employee number 47, and I was the media department. You know, I did all the sponsored garage tours. You had to multitask then. So doing the launch, and I used to love my launches, and Eddie was brilliant to work with on that score, because he loved the drama and he loved the theatre of it. And so we did great things, like, you know, I remember when Peugeot came on board as our engine supplier, we converted what at the time was an empty part of the factory into a French cafe style bistro, and we hung you know, star cloth all around it, and had this very theatrical launch, and it was bloody hard work when you're doing all of that on your own, and that includes photocopying, you know, the press pack, as it was at the time. I can remember the relief when Eddie agreed to stump up the budget that I could actually send that off somewhere else to get the photocopies done, because back in the day, I'd be photocopying it off, stapling it, shoving it in the packs, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So running downstairs, making sure that the photographers were getting the shots of the new car, all of that kind of stuff. But that time was just brilliant, because down in the workshop, the boys were all working till 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning as well. So it was really, really long hours. You're not allowed to do them now, but there was a real, you know, if you hadn't done at least five all-nighters before the start of the season, quite frankly, you're a bit of a Jesse. So I kind of bought into that, and I enjoyed the stress of it. And then it would get to the big day of the launch and you're just juggling. You've got plates spinning all over the place. And I'd then go into kind of swan mode, trying to look serene on the outside as the journalists were all arriving, and then dashing off bangs, back out being all serene again. And I loved it. And still now I find, you know, I've mentioned earlier on, I'm one of life's great procrastinators. I'll put things off till the last minute. And then I've got a pressure. And I'm thinking to myself, why are you sat here at 8:30 at night? If you'd started writing this training session at 10 o'clock this morning, you know, you could be sitting with your feet up in front of the telly now. But it's just, it's not the way I work. I like having that little bit of stress, having that little bit of pressure.
I do. Actually, hearing you describe it that way reminds me, I love that bit. Unfortunately, I think I tend to go a bit beyond that, which is not so great. But one of the things I was taught really early on, actually, was you don't run. You never run in front of the rest of the paddock. You wait till you run the corner and then you sprint.
Yeah, you never, never run in the paddock. It shows that you're, absolutely. The other thing I was told by somebody, another reporter, and then all the guys on the crew said, that's bullshit, is never carry the legs. So the legs are the stand, you know, the sticks that a camera would go on, a broadcast camera. Someone said, never carry the sticks. Never carry the sticks. That's the crew's job to do that. But yeah, you try that with my guys. It's not my style anyway. I'd much rather be one of the boys and join in and muck in with everybody. Can't say one of the boys anymore, can we? It's one of the girls, really. But it very much was one of the boys in my early days. So
actually, I would love to talk to you about that, because, and tell me if I'm wrong, but I get the sense that you were the first woman doing an awful lot of things in motorsport. Is that true?
There weren't many. When I first walked into the Formula One paddock, there were not that many girls around. There were Annie Bradshaw, who I mentioned earlier, was there. There were a handful, and literally probably one hand of female press officers, if that. The only engineer, or the engineer I remember really well, was a French lady called Valerie, who was, don't ask me what her job title was, but she was something very high up at Elf, who were a fuel supplier for quite a few of the teams at the time. A couple of female journalists, but, you know, we used to have a gathering of all of the girls in the paddock. And okay, there would be a few of them, the motorhome girls, who couldn't make it along because it was an evening gathering and they were busy doing supper. And there were probably a couple of the journalists, female journalists, who didn't come along. But we would fit inside the awning of one motorhome. And I'm talking an awning back in the days of a fabric awning, so on the side of a bus, rather than the, you know, the sort of constructions that the team have now. I've got a succession of pictures of us all, and there'd be, you know, there'd be 20, 30 girls there. So we were few and far between, and that's, you know, back in my very early days, we were even less. So, but you just kind of blobbed on in there. In fact, when Tony Jardine first sent me to work for Leighton House doing the BP work, Ian Phillips, who was then the boss at Leighton House, Tony said, I've got this girl, Louise Goodman, who's going to come. And he said, no, I'm not having a girl. Not having a girl. Don't want a girl on the team as a press officer. Tony said, well, no, she's good. I don't want a girl. And Tony said, well, you've got her. And to his credit, you know, I think it was a long time before Ian, who then went on to Jordan and actually was instrumental along with EJ of, you know, inviting me to go and work at Jordan, both of whom are still friends nowadays. So I think it was a long time before Ian had another male press officer, because he actually realised that there was something that, as a woman, I brought to the job. It was, which was basically, you know, I was telling the drivers what to do, trying to get them to do stuff, sponsor appearances and that kind of thing. And you know, I could just cajole them. I think, cut to its essence, they found it more difficult to tell me to piss off than they would have done a bloke. So, you know, and I always think as well, I'm 5'10" and bossy, and I think that's probably worked in my favour in my career as well. I'm sure there are girls, and I have heard stories of girls working in motorsport who have felt intimidated. They've felt, you know, put upon, and they've felt that they've been sort of prey to sort of sexism. But I can only speak from my own experience. And other than that one with Ian Phillips, and there was one occasion when in Imola, and this was back in the Leighton House days, I was walking to go onto the grid with the team, and one of the marshals there stopped me and said, no, you can't go on the grid. And thankfully, all the boys who I was walking with went, oh, don't challenge her. Come on, Lou, you know, she's with us, and shuffled me through. And those really are the, you know, probably the only two instances of sexism. I don't know what people were saying about me behind my back. I don't really care. But, you know, I've been very lucky in that respect, that I haven't been subject to it. I made it clear from the outset, you know, there was me, and there was a girl called Henny who worked in the motorhome. And I made it clear from the outset, I'm here to work. Don't even think about it. And I think, you know, once I'd kept the boys at arm's bay and they'd realised I wasn't some girly girl who was there to be pushed around, I earned their respect, and then I was given their respect. So, and had a good working relationship, I'd like to think, with everybody and with all of the drivers who I worked with. I struggle sometimes when I look at some of the press. I think the relationship between drivers and PRs is different now, in that the drivers seem to have a lot more control, a lot more sway. You know, at times I'm waiting to speak to a driver and I can see the PR, to my mind, faffing. I'm thinking, just bloody tell them, get your ass out there, mate. This is part of your job. You shouldn't be kowtowing to that bloke. And it generally is a bloke as a driver. And, you know, just tell him, get your ass out now, media time, get your ass out there. And no, you haven't finished. Go back in. You missed that journalist. Go. Maybe that's just me. I do appreciate it. It's a different era now. It's a different media era specifically. There is a lot more call on driver's time. But it goes back to what I said earlier on about being tall and bossy. I think that's my way. I say do it. If I didn't need you to do it, I wouldn't be asking you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Talk to me about your proudest moment. Do you have one so far in your career? And most importantly, because I find in motorsport we move so freaking quickly that we don't take the time, did you get to celebrate it?
I couldn't pick a proudest moment. I have several moments that I remember that stand out for me. I think when I was working for a team, I never worked for a team that won a race. So that was a kind of a box I failed to tick. But I do remember those moments when we got a podium finish and the thrill of that, the thrill of, you know, with Leighton House. Don't ask me what year it was, but it was late 89, 90. Anyway, the car had failed to qualify in Brazil. And then we were running first and second for part of the race at the following race at the French Grand Prix. Avancapelli eventually finished second. And that was, you know, just such a thrill. So team results were always great. Results with Jordan, you know, when we got drivers on the podium again, they were brilliant. And then I think when I started working in broadcasting, you know, getting that first interview with Eddie Jordan, that was a big moment. I remember my very first Grand Prix working with ITV and I was so nervous. I had very little broadcast experience. I'd done a little bit of work with RTE, the Irish TV station that was covering Formula One at the time. And they just gave me a microphone and said, listen, can we come down to you every now and then in the Jordan garage and you can give us an update on what's going on? But, you know, when I started working for ITV, they kind of gave me a microphone and said, off you go. And I chatted. James Allen was a great help. He'd been working for ESPN and gave me some tips and pointers. The biggest bonus was that I knew the drivers. I'd been around the paddock. I'd worked with them all. In teams alongside them, or rival teams, but they knew me. They could see I was nervous. And on the Melbourne, our first Grand Prix was in Melbourne, and I was doing an interview on the grid with Eddie Irvine, who I'd worked with. He was one of the drivers I worked with at Jordan. And Irv was kind of slumped down on the grass on the sort of fan side of the track, of the grid. And I thought, if I ask him to stand up, I'm going to get one of those. I'll just sit down alongside him and do the interview that way. And afterwards, Neil Duncanson, who was our boss at the time, said, that was exactly what you want, Louise, a different style, a different way of doing it. Just that cat. And I thought, oh, that was good then. So I always remember that. And a lot of it centered around, as I said, results, and getting good interviews with drivers that I'd worked with. I remember my interview with Rubens in Germany when he won the Grand Prix, was a special one. That one with Lewis, who's not a driver that I'd ever worked with. I didn't have a close relationship with him as I perhaps did with some of the others. That was the ITV finale. We were going out on a high. It was the first time we'd ever bloody well had a British world champion in the entire time that we were covering the sport. So getting that last interview was really important. And Jensen's first win as well. That will always stick with me, just because he's such a lovely bloke and he'd been waiting such a long time. And it was just, you build a relationship with people. I think a lot of my work, or the way that I work as a reporter, I'm not so interested in or be knowledgeable about the technical side of things. I obviously, you have to have a technical knowledge so that you know what you're talking about, but it's not what gets me excited. It's not what lights my fire. I like the personalities. And I think in order to get personalities out of people, you have to build some kind of, working relationship with the drivers. It makes them more relaxed. You'll get more out of them. There was one occasion actually with Eddie Irvine when at the Hungarian Grand Prix, he told me, and I can't remember exactly what it was he told me, but as he was saying it, that the press officer in me was saying, oh my God, you shouldn't be telling me this. And the reporter was going, brilliant. Oh, I've got something mega there. And afterwards, Eddie got a proper bollocking from Ferrari about it. And he said, I forgot. I was just talking to you. Sorry, terrible Northern Irish accent. But he just, because we knew each other well, he was just shooting the shit with me. He kind of forgotten that, this was going to be broadcast. So I got a really good little nugget of an interview. I'm sorry it got him into trouble, but it was a brilliant little scoop for ITV that, that he shouldn't have given me.
I work exactly the same. It's actually really nice for me to hear you say all those things, because I recognise myself in that. And I'm the same. I understand the technology. I'm knowledgeable on it because that's my job. But I'm here for the people. Yeah. I really am.
Yeah. And the racing as well. I love the racing. I genuinely love the racing. I genuinely get excited about it. Working in the British Touring Car Championship now, I'm jumping up and down and shouting at the television, don't you bloody well, don't part, I get involved and engaged in. It's a different style of racing in touring cars and in the support races that we get in touring cars as well. It's a lot more elbow to elbow. It's proper rubbing is racing. Kind of style. There's a lot of overtaking. It's short races. It's I always describe Formula One is an engineering championship, and British Touring Car Championship is an entertainment series. So that for me is the difference. But it's just exciting, and I am jumping up and down. And so there's a lot of thrill comes out of that as well. And then you get lost in the moment of it with people and seeing their emotions. Once a year, pretty much every year since I've been working in the BTCC, I'm standing there when the championship winner comes into Parc Fermé, saying to myself, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry, because I can, when you see their emotions pouring out of them, it's, you've got to maintain that professionalism and that balance. You're still there to do your job, not hug and kiss them and say, oh, that was bloody brilliant, mate. But those emotions, you connect with them 100%. And it's part of my job to draw those emotions out of people as well, because that's what people want to see. The real, nobody wants to see boring, bland drivers giving us PR bullshit. It's not entertaining. It's not entertaining for me as a fan, and it's not entertaining the kind of entertainment that I want to provide to people watching the programmes I'm involved with. So
yeah. I'm relating 100%. Also, the thing is, it's a lot easier to shout at the television about someone overtaking somebody when you know them both. You know, you literally, they're your mates and you can see them. You know exactly what they're thinking and how they're going about racing. And you more often than not, you know what they're going to do next as well.
You know their characters, what they're more likely to do, who's going to have a go.
To be fair, we've discussed the highs. Do you have any low moments? And I hope a way of climbing out of them and overcoming them.
I mean, there have been low moments. There have been a few, you know, low moments related to the racing. I was in Imola in 1994, and that's a weekend that everybody who was there will remember. Just the weirdest weekend that started actually with one of my drivers, Rubens Barrichello, having a huge shunt, and obviously then Roland was killed on the Saturday and Ayrton died on the Sunday. So that was a tricky weekend for everybody, or some more so than others. But, you know, it, just the whole weekend was the oddest atmosphere. And so that will always stick with me as a memorable weekend for all the wrong reasons. I think other lows on a professional level, I suppose, it wasn't a low so much as a challenge. My first year working as a broadcaster, I was very mindful of the fact that I didn't really know what I was learning it as I went along in a very public environment. You know, we had millions of people tuning in to watch the shows in those days. You know, audiences have dissipated to a certain extent and have spread over, you know, you've got Sky and Channel 4, and so the audiences are smaller, but we had millions and millions of people tuning in. So I was learning my trade in a very public place, and quite frankly at the beginning of it I wasn't very good. I spoke too high, too fast, I got terribly nervous, you know, and I'm not very good at not being very good at things, and I would go home and cry thinking, Jesus, that's embarrassing, I'm really shit. And I also felt like I'd lost my home. I'd worked in Formula One for, you know, a reasonable amount of time at that point, but I'd always had a home. It was either in the Leighton House motorhome or it was in the Jordan motorhome. Suddenly, I didn't feel like I belonged in any of those team garages or motorhomes, but I didn't feel like I belonged in the TV compound either, because I didn't know all the people. I didn't feel like I was truly part of that world. Luckily, Martin Brundle was in exactly the same position as me, because he was the driver at Jordan in my final year there. So he was one of the last drivers that I worked with as his press officer. We made the switch over at the same time. So we would have conversations about, we don't know where to go now. Where do we go to have a coffee? Because I still had that odd feeling walking into, you know, McLaren, like, come and have a coffee here. But I was like, I'm going to McLaren. It just didn't feel right. So that first year was tough. And I remember when we got to the end of it, we all went out and had a sort of team dinner, all of the crew from ITV. And I felt like I was finding my feet by that point. And, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm on the road here. And there was a big party. It was in Portugal, the season, Portugal, Spain. And there was a big party, Formula One party. I went along and some drunk mechanic came up to me and said, oh, you're that girl who doesn't tell you what, my wife thinks you're shit. She turns the volume down whenever you come on. And I luckily, had he said that to me halfway through the season, I would have been really upset. But at that point, and particularly having just come out of a team dinner when the boss had praised it all and you know, noted, I know for some of you it's been a difficult year, you've started. So I was like, I just thought, I don't give a what your wife thinks. Bleep that bit out. My boss is happy with what I'm doing, and so that was a professional low point as well. And on a very, very personal level, the loss of my partner John Walton was very much a low point, as you can imagine, in life and in work, and the two were kind of centered around each other, because he worked in Formula One as well. So that was a tough time, but I have to say as well, that was one of those times when Formula One wraps its arms around you when you need it, very much so. And that was very much one of those times when I was very aware of the fact I was in the arms of a loving, caring family, both in the paddock and from ITV as well, who were all absolutely brilliant with me.
You've touched on something that actually I think might be the thing I love most about motorsport, and I wanted to ask you how you felt. Motorsport to me is a family. We're a big, messy circus, Boater family.
It is. And I walk into the Formula One paddock now, and because I'm not in the Formula One paddock so often, I can see some of the, you know, some of the youngsters who are just starting out haven't got a clue who I am and why the hell should they? I'm not in the paddock on a very regular basis. I'll do maybe 2 Grand Prix in the paddock a year. I can see them looking at me thinking, who the heck's that woman, when I stick my head into their, you know, into their team building. And then the team boss will walk out. The team boss, who was like a number 2 mechanic when I first knew him. So, you know, and there is that, like, yeah, how you doing? We're all still here. You know, Lindy Redding, who you know well, who, you know, the doyen of the sort of catering companies in Formula One, Absolute Taste. You know, Lindy and I sort of started out together. So we'll get together in Melbourne every year and have a glass of champagne and celebrate. Yeah, that's another year that we've done together. And so, yeah, though I think those, I don't know all of the younger members of the family, but the older members of the family are the ones who I grew up with. And there is still very much that feeling of yeah, yeah. And you'll see them jumping around. And also, you know, you walk into, I remember going to Le Mans for the first time, working at Le Mans a few years back. And it's like, oh, bloody hell. Oh, you're here. Oh, wow. You're working. Oh, bloody hell. There's another person, you know, who, and it's the same in, you know, now in touring cars, that there's an engineer who works in touring cars who worked at Leighton House 30 years ago, you know, so these people are still around. We still see each other. And I do love that aspect of it.
I love that too. I feel like you get given the keys. It's almost, I don't want to call it a membership because that sounds too exclusive, but you're like given the keys to something. And I know I haven't been to a touring car, British or world touring car race in about 10 years, but I know when I walk in,
yeah,
I'll know people either, yeah, from when I was working there or someone that's come over from F1 more, yeah, recently.
Absolutely. I love it. Yeah.
And we are never, we're never stronger together than when something bad happens. Unfortunately, I wish that wasn't the case, but that, yeah, then you really feel it. Definitely.
Absolutely.
I'd like to ask you about social media, because it's a big part of motorsport these days, partly how, you know, it gets broadcasted out to the world, but also just in our daily lives, how we use it. We're all on our freaking phones. What's your take on it? How do you use it or not use it?
It's a bit of a double-edged sword for me, because obviously, with my media training hat on, I am 100% aware that social media is a necessary and a vital and valuable tool for my clients, be they individual drivers I'm working with, organizations I'm working with, you know, racing teams, or, you know, businesses outside of motorsport, because I've sort of done training across the board in lots of different areas. It's so important. It's massively important. It is how we connect with the world to a large extent. You know, the traditional media has kind of lessened in its impact. I mentioned earlier on the numbers that we used to get watching our television programs. You know, I think we peaked one Canadian Grand Prix at 12 million or something like that. Okay, it had overrun and we got into Coronation Street time. But, you know, we regularly got multiple millions. If we'd only got 6 million people watching a Grand Prix, it was like, oh shit, that was a bad audience, wasn't it? You just don't get those numbers now because A, there are a lot more sports, B, people get their sport in different ways, and different age groups engage with life in different ways. So whether you like it or not, social media is here to stay. It's incredibly useful. It's incredibly important. And I will spend a lot of time in my training sessions talking about how people can use it to their benefit, how they should, you know, in training people specifically for making videos, for, you know, that they can use on their social media. It's a very, very intimate form of contact with fans, and fans want that contact. Sport like Formula One, that's got massive, great big physical barriers between the teams, the drivers and the fans, for obvious reasons. You know, you can't let the Formula One paddock be overrun with fans just because nobody would ever get any work done. It's and from, you know, commercial reasons as well, it's, that's just not the way that it works. But that engagement is so important. So I am very, very aware and mindful of the importance and the value of social media. When it's for myself, I'm bloody awful at it. I really am. I'm just a bit, you know, do I look at Facebook? No. I think of it as work. I think of social media as work. I have a lot of followers on Facebook, but they're not people that I have some friends, obviously, but a lot of people I've just made contact with. I made the mistake, and I say mistake, in the early days, I just had a Facebook profile. So, of course, you're limited then with the numbers of people. I reached the 5,000 ages ago. I didn't set up a fan page early enough, which is what I should have done, which means that I can't really use it for personal things, because I'm not the kind of person who wants to share my everyday life with everybody. And I, you know, it's just the way I am. I want to do what I want to do when I'm away from work. So, as I say, I think of it very much as work. I'm not the kind of person who sits there scrolling through Facebook. I'll get to a racetrack and think, oh shit, I really ought to tweet something. Oh bloody hell, I forgot to take some pictures to put on my Instagram. Even when I'm doing my training. So, you know, there's me banging on to people about the commercial value of social media. It's a real case of do as I say, not as I do, because I think very often I'm too busy doing it myself. I'm too busy doing my job to actually be able to keep across my social media. I now employ, I have a lovely lady called Shari, who I'm very lucky to have somebody doing my hair and makeup at the British Touring Car Championship, which is necessary because it's a full day long show. I've appointed Shari as my social media manager. So she's following me around, taking pictures the whole time and putting together my pair, because I don't have the time. I'm not there to be posting pictures of myself. I'm there to do a job. So, yeah, that's, as I say, Shari is now my appointed social media manager. Sounds frightfully posh, doesn't it? But I just, yeah, it's just the way it is, because I know it's got to be done. And there is a, you know, I should be promoting my own business and I should be doing more of that. In fact, one of the things I have been doing in lockdown is forward planning, a little bit of forward planning. I have written some social media scripts, which I intend to film when I can, when we're out of lockdown, and just some little videos to put on my social media about media training tips and presentation skills training tips. So get me being proactive and forward planning. Yeah, that's where I am with social media. It's a kind of love-hate relationship.
All I heard was that you proactively delegated. That sounds very good.
Yeah, but very much after the event. I should have been doing it years ago. And I also, I'm a wordsmith, so I'll put together a tweet, you know, and 20 minutes later, I'm still working on the punctuation and thinking, oh, can I phrase that? It's an immediate thing, you know. It's
not the best platform for a wordsmith, I don't think.
No, I spend far too long, as I say, trying to kind of craft the perfect. And then I look at other people's tweets and think, oh, it's much better than mine, you know, because I'm not practicing what I preach. I'm not being myself. I'm not being having that, you know, one-to-one contact and just being me with it. I think my job as a reporter, I feel like I am there as the means through which the fans get to see the drivers. I'm not there to be on television. That, I think, is the difference. I've still got I love my job. I love what I do. I'm not shy about it in that respect, but it's not about me, it's about the people I'm speaking to. So I think putting it out there to people, it's about me, this is about me, it's just not who I am. Everyone's different in that way.
Yeah, it jars. Actually, talking about everyone else, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, to anyone that's looking in who perhaps looks at your career and would love to do the same, what advice would you give anyone these days?
Oh, this is such a tricky one. And as you can imagine, I've been asked it quite a few times. That's not to be rude about your question. It's a very relevant question, because I think it's important to try and help other, particularly girls, because I think it still is, you know, there is still this perception out there that motorsport is for boys. And it's not the people within the sport, it's people externally who think that. So I do think it's important to try and help other people per se, but other girls in particular who want to get involved. And my main advice to everybody is, you've just got to get stuck in there and do it and make yourself useful, really. You know, it's not going to come to you. You need to go out there and find it. You're not going to walk. I was very lucky. My first job in motorsport was in Formula One. That's not going to happen nowadays. It's a different world we live in. It's a different sport, and it's a different world from an employment perspective as well. So, you know, just get yourself experience, go to local racetracks, make friends, meet people. It's definitely a bit about what you know, but it's a lot about who you know as well. It's about contacts. You know, we've talked about the fact it's a family, and, you know, it's about knowing people in that family. It's about making contacts in that family. And just then you'll be in their minds. I'm sure there are other people in other areas. You know, I'm not suggesting that if you're an engineer, you need to have the right qualifications. You need to have the CV. You need to have the university degree that states you're capable of doing the job. But certainly, I think for the side that I work in, it's about just getting stuck in there and making yourself useful and making those contacts and saying, you know, if you want to PR, go to a national touring car race or a national race and find out, you know, which teams maybe don't have a press office and which teams would like a bit of a hand. And then you can do some bits and bobs from then you've got stuff you can show to people. You've got a foot in the door and you've got a body of work that you can show to people. I think that really is the best tip that I can give to people based on my experience, which, as I say, I'm aware is slightly out of touch in terms of employment methods these days and how things come about. But I think that's still going to stand you in good stead. You know, I think having somebody within a race team, say, or a mate of mine's interested, is always going to get looked at closer than another CV arriving through the post, which again, there are lots of them that do.
And having some experience in, you know, showing that you're not after Formula One, that you're actually willing to graft
in motorsport. Yeah. I mean, we talked earlier on about you can't be a fan. Yes, you've got to be a fan of the sport, but you're not there to be a fan. So, you know, I used to get letters from people. Oh, I just love Formula One. I really want to work in Formula One. What do you want to do? Oh, I don't care. I just want to work in Formula One. Well, you know, that's not going to work. You're not there to do a job. You're there because you want to stand and go, oh my God, look, it's Lewis Hamilton. Oh my God, look, it's, you know, Kimi Raikkonen. Nobody's going to employ you on that basis. They want to see that you're, you know, it is long hours. We talked about the fact it's long hours, it's hard work. You've got to prove that you're capable of doing it because there's a lot of people want to work in this industry. So you've got to prove that you've got the backbone for it.
What about advice that you've been given? Is there something that sticks out that you've carried to this day?
Neil Duncanson, my boss at North One TV when I first came in, so he used to say, because I was very nervous, I talked very high, and Neil would say to me, Louise, low and slow. And I will still find myself saying that to people sometimes in my media training sessions when they're getting overexcited and look a bit frustrated, getting a bit nervous. Low and slow. That's the bit of advice that always stands out for me, that's for sure. I think, you know, the rest of it I just kind of made up as I went along. So there was no sort of standout thing that somebody had said, if you do it this way, it'll work out for you.
Low and slow. I'm gonna take that, please. That's that's good. I definitely go high pitch as soon as I'm nervous or excited.
Everybody does. When I'm working my media training, it's one of those tools. If you want to make it sound exciting, you talk kind of faster. But if you want gravitas, you go low and slow, and then it sounds a lot more important.
It also sounds bloody sexy. I'm getting shivers.
Bless you. I haven't lost it.
I actually cannot believe it. I've got my page in front of me just to make sure that I don't miss out any topic. And this is the last question.
Oh,
what are you looking forward to?
This is going to sound terrible. Retiring. It's a little way off yet. But one of my great loves in life is travel. I love traveling. And that was one of the aspects of Formula One that I always loved. I got to travel. And yes, I didn't get to hang out at every race I went to, but I made sure that over the course of the years I was doing it, I spent time in the places that I was at. There's loads of places in the world I want to go and see. There's loads of places still on my list I want to tick off. So that's kind of, you know, I love life at the moment. I love working, don't get me wrong. And okay, I'm getting on a bit, but I'm not that old yet. I'm in a position to retire. I don't really have any, because as I said earlier on, I'd never set myself any. When I'm 25, I want to be doing this. When I'm 30, I want to be doing that. I've never set myself those goals. So I don't really have those goals that I'm working towards. The thing that I think, oh, that would be brilliant is, oh God, when I can go to Syria, when I can do those bits of South America, when I can, you know, go to Cambodia, I haven't been to. And I have this little game I play with myself, whereas I have to have been to more countries than I have years of age. Trust me, it's getting more and more difficult as my years of age go up. But I actually counted it up with a friend the other day. I'm two ahead. I'm two countries ahead. So I've got to maintain that. I've got a couple of years in hand, which given this year is a good thing, because I don't think I'm going to be ticking any new countries off the list this year. But I would love to be able to maintain that till my dying day.
If ever you stated a goal, that's a good one.
It's a good one, isn't it? Think of all those beaches I can visit. Lovely.
That's brilliant. I can't believe I'm saying that, but that's it. That was all my questions. Thank you so, so much for doing this with me.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me. And good job, can I just say? My professional opinion. I think you did a lovely job. I bet you don't broadcast that bit.
I'm going to press the stop.
Thank you so much for agreeing to chat to me for Racing Lives, Louise. It absolutely made my day. My microphone misbehaved there at the end, so to clarify, I said something along the lines of, I'm embarrassed now and I'm going to have to stop, which is completely true. I've admired Louise for years. She is so good at everything she does, has an incredible career. She's deeply knowledgeable about motorsport and is one of the nicest people I've met in this sport, as I'm sure you sensed while listening to our chat. So to receive praise from Louise as I begin my podcasting journey is a big moment. Thank you once more, Louise, for being so generous with your time and your story. As ever, if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe via your favourite podcast platform and leave us a review if that function is available on that platform. It helps people find us, but it also means so much, and you know I'll be reading all of them. You can also get in touch directly if you'd like via my Instagram account, which is Pandeia, Pandeia. Thank you very much for listening, and speak to you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.